Alternate History Show with Ben Kearns. In association with AlternateHistory.com, the world's premier alternate history discussion site.
And this is part three of your alternate history show for today. And we've been revisiting past glories, so to speak, of the alternate history show over the past 12 months. And part one and two of today's show was largely focused on discussions about what might have happened. In part three, later on, we got something a little bit different, although something which we always do. We'll be linking up with Alex Wallace to catch up on the alternate history news of the time with our feedback hub. That's on the way in about 10 minutes time, just under 10 minutes I reckon. First off, it's time to recap on the 60 second summaries that I've done in the past few months or so. On every show I try and get hold of some alternate history media and literature and review it for you. It's normally related in some way, shape or form to what we're talking about in the main thrust of the show. We're going to revisit previous 60-second summaries, starting in the very first episode, when I was discussing some alternate history to do with the Second World War.
The Alternate History Show presents the 60-second summary.
The Man in the High Castle was written and set in 1962 America, 15 years after the capitulation of the US forces to the Nazis and the Japanese. It was set 15 years after the end of the Second World War, and the US is now divided into two nations, one run by the Germans and one run by the Japanese. And the Japanese in particular are very interested in Americana, as they call it. So memorabilia from before the Second World War in this timeline. And that is basically what the alternate history is about, largely selling antiques and uncovering the past and uncovering feelings of the past. The point of departure is in 1933 when Zangara kills Franklin Roosevelt and is succeeded, therefore, by John Nance Garner. And the nightmare carries on from there, and I've run out of time, haven't I? So there you go. That's enough for you to go on. Go and buy The Man in the High Castle when you can. Get Back was set originally in 1968, involving George Harrison speaking up, the Quiet Beatle, as he was dubbed. In this timeline, decides to call a crisis meeting regarding Apple. It may surprise you that Harrison did this because he was the least enthusiastic about the project. However, in some ways, this gives him the impetus to put Apple Music on a firmer footing. It does get onto a firmer footing in 1969, leading to a lack of a need to immediately resolve the management crisis, leading to the lack of an Eastman versus Klein battle, and that in turn leads to the Beatles recording well into 1976, although George Harrison does partake in a temporary exodus from the band.
This is the Feedback Hub.
And welcome to your Feedback Hub, your first one in a little while at least, and it's a brand new one, unlike the rest of the show, which has been a best of. And I'm joined, as always, on the Feedback Hub by Alex Wallace. He is with me. He is here. Hello, Alex.
Hello, Ben. Nice to be here, as always.
It's good to have you with us. It really is. It's good to have you with us. How you been over the past few months or so, since we last caught up?
As well as you can be during a global pandemic.
Well, let's talk about what you've been up to. And I suppose there has been positive news in the sense that you've actually penned a couple of articles, which I have read, and they're both very good, for Sea Lion Press. Tell us a little bit more about them. What are they about?
So the most recent one that was published today, at least American time, was on Sea Lion Press about H.G. Wells' The World Set Free, which I remember discussing on a previous Feedback Hub.
Yes.
H.G. Wells' prediction of nuclear war.
Oh, yes.
How eerily prescient that was. Since then, we've also had one on H.G. Wells' The War in the Air, which predicted World War II strategic bombing. There's one on one of my pet issues in the community. Bad sex scenes in Alden history novels.
Are there many?
Yes.
Oh, well.
Unfortunately.
Right, yes. Yeah.
To my great chagrin.
Yes.
And this is not only in print now.
How long have you been writing for Sea Lion Press for, then? Because the first I knew of it was sort of June time, when I saw a post on Facebook of yours that said, "Oi, I'm writing for Sea Lion Press, and I've written this article," and it's a very interesting article on the different types of alternate history. So how long have you been writing for them?
Sometime in June. I wrote, like, 6 articles in June, and they're still publishing those. I think there are 2 more part of that group.
Wow.
Excuse me. And there are 2 more after that I've written in the past month that'll be out probably sometime in October. And there's more on the way, certainly.
Okay, well, that's good. We'll await with bated breath, as they say, whoever they happen to be. And what else have you been up to over the past few months or so in terms of AH? What have you been doing? What have you been spending your time with? Because, well, we're going to come on to what we're going to be doing on next month's show a little bit later on. But aside from that, what have you been up to?
Well, just last night, I watched an AH adjacent movie on Disney Plus, The Rocketeer, which was pretty great.
Okay.
Very diesel punky.
Yeah, you wouldn't necessarily associate Disney Plus with AH, but yeah, interesting.
I mean, it was there. I've seen it talked about a lot in nerd circles as a great example of diesel punk, so I gave it a shot, and I quite enjoyed it. I just like that sort of interwar aesthetic. Mm. Talk about that a bit in the War in the Air article for SLP about how there's this certain romanticization of the interwar years as this glamorous time.
Yes, particularly the Roaring Twenties, I suppose.
Yes, absolutely.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, you know, it's interesting. Interesting, actually, that you mentioned that, because I have been reading up a little bit on the Roaring Twenties, not roaring so much, which I will go into, actually, now. I've been reading up on an article about the Washington Naval Conference, which is perhaps a slightly underlooked point of departure in terms of alternate history, mainly because of its success, I suppose, or the success that it seemed it was at the time, in that it prevented the Anglo-American War of the 1930s, that some people say, and some people say it possibly prevented an American-Japanese War and that kind of stuff. Well, I was reading an article on what if that hadn't happened, and it stipulates a very different 1930s stemming from a war in the early 30s, just after the Wall Street crash. I also read a timeline a couple of weeks back, actually, now, which was unfortunately incomplete, about the idea of prohibition in the UK and in Canada. A lot of people assume it was a specifically US-focused thing, and it was in some ways, but in some ways it sort of wasn't, really, in that there was a lot of calls for regulation of alcohol at the time throughout various communities in various places. This guy had managed to sort out a plausible way in which we could have had some sort of prohibition in the UK at the same time as the US equivalent. I was hoping he would complete it, because I'd like to know how that would pan out in his view. What else have you been doing, Alex?
One author I've recently discovered that I want to promote to the Alden history community, because his work seems not to be categorized Alden history when it very much is,
yep,
is a writer named P. J. Lee Clark.
Right.
Middle name is D-J-E-L-I. It's that is a term for a West African storyteller. He is African American. He has written multiple works of fantasy alternate history that I thought were all fantastic. And one of them, The Haunting of Trampar 015, was nominated for a Hugo Award for Best Novella this year. It didn't win.
Mm.
But it was the one I was rooting for. I just thought that one was what Clark did was fantastic. It's this urban fantasy 1920s Cairo, stemming from when a man in Egypt in the 1880s unleashes traditional Arab magic upon the world.
Right.
And Egypt gets its independence decades ahead of schedule.
Interesting.
It's, I don't want to spoil too much, but it's a fantastic book. It has a novelette in the same universe, A Dead Djinn in Cairo, which is also very good. Shorter, but quite good. And I hear he is working on a novel in that setting, and I am greatly looking forward to that.
You will keep your ears pinned to the ground, and we'll track it down as well. Vaguely heard of the name, I must admit, but you know, I'd never really associated him with alternate history in particular. Say, I very vaguely heard of the name. Why do you think that it's not considered alternate history by a lot of people, and why should it be, in your words?
In the article I wrote for SLP about alternate history at the 2020 Hugos, Colin Salt, who appeared on this show last December, he was talking about how there's so much alternate history that is published in science fiction fantasy circles that is not marketed as alternate history, and goes to show that how much of this is just marketing. I would guess that the publishers of Clark's work aren't thinking of it as something to be marketed to the same people as, say, Turtledove or Starling or Flint. I think that it very much is alternate history, because there is a concrete point divergence both in his fantasy Cairo and also in his other work, the Black God's Drum, which is about a 19th century New Orleans run by African Americans in a North America that was balkanized in the 19th century.
Okay.
Also involving West African magic, which was also a very good book.
What have you been up to on in terms of your websites, in terms of Alternate History Online and the Alternate Timelines Forum? What's the discussion? What's a discussion that sort of leaped out at you, so to speak?
There's an interesting post about bureaucracy as an ideology in Alternate History Online that's gotten some good discussion.
Okay.
That one commenter says that it would be influenced by James Burnham's work. Also, I want to say, was it Frederick Jackson Turner? No, well, different Turner, but there's another theorist in the early 20th century named Turner who talks a lot about industrialism. And I think those alternate ideologies of the early 20th century is an interesting thing, because as you said, Ben, that the Roaring 20s weren't roaring for everyone, and you had like street fights between fascists and communists in Germany,
yes,
among other places.
Of course, yeah.
I mean, you had fascism thought of as a legitimate form of social organization. Hell, even H.G. Wells in The Shape of Things to Come said that fascism predated certain aspects of his future history. And it really shows how that book was written in like the mid-30s,
yes,
before the World War II and fascism becoming the dirty word that is now. I mean, on the topic of The Shape of Things to Come, another really good alternate history work that I recommend.
Yeah.
The Time Ships by Stephen Baxter.
I've heard of that, yes.
Which is his sequel to Wells' The Time Machine.
Yeah.
And he takes that, I mean, and The Time Machine is only about a 90-page book. It turns into a sweeping time travel epic in the way that he turned The War of the Worlds into terrifying hard science fiction in The Massacre of Mankind. One part of The Time Shifts is a alternate history based upon, among other things, Wells' depiction of the future in The Shape of Things to Come. And
yes,
it's this really eerie depiction of a Britain in a world where World War I never ended. And it's some of the most compelling dystopian alternate history I've ever read. So that's another book I recommend.
I'd say it's interesting about the alternate ideology. I'm assuming you have read the unification timeline, the unity timeline that's floating around online somewhere that I came across absolutely ages ago.
It's not ringing a bell, to be perfectly honest with you.
Ah, right, okay, interesting. It's basically, it's sort of like fascism, but less fascist in terms of less hatred towards individual groups, and instead more totalitarianism. And as a result of that, it sort of survives and thrives because it's less hateful to individual people, if that makes sense. But it's pretty much hateful to everyone equally, in a sense, who isn't wealthy.
Yeah. If we're talking about alternate fascisms, I like to point out, and this was something I mentioned a year ago when we did the World War II episode.
Yes.
Pablo Portillo's Shadow of Montreux, about a world where Nazi Germany and fascist Italy go to war over Austria.
Yep.
And this leads to the discrediting of Nazism, but Italian fascism retains its cachet with certain ones of intellectuals, and you have fascist parties being elected all over the West in the coming decades, and that's a very interesting alternate history about fascism in alternate contexts.
All right, what's been your alternate history pick of the week, Alex?
Part of me wants to say The Haunting of Frank R15, but I've already discussed that.
Okay.
So I'm going to name another work I wanted to bring up that I haven't mentioned yet. David Oliver Goderich's Metamorphosis.
Right.
Which is set several hundred years ago in what we would call British Columbia.
Right, okay.
Where the indigenous people are contacted by a vote from Song Dynasty China. This was something I had found through a review on the SLP blog by Adam Selby Martin, and it was a very well done review, and it inspired me to get the book, and it's a very good book. It's a sort of post-colonial alternate history that P.J. Lee Clark writes, and a couple of other writers, Robert Sullivan's London Waka, definitely, and it's just that sort of thing that shows that alternate history is more than just, and this is me contradicting myself in your CCR recording we did.
Oh,
that
yes.
That alternate history isn't always war epics.
No, of course not.
It's done in the vein of, say, The Years of Rice and Salt or Through Darkest Europe, and it's fantastic.
Mm. Okay, excellent stuff. Now, if you got anything else to say, Alex, anything of note?
I was on another podcast called Living a Life Through Books, in which I talk all of the history with a her name's Shanaz Ahmed, and that was a great discussion.
Yep.
So hunt that down if you're interested in me talking about more nerd stuff.
Thanks as always to Alex Wallace for another amazingly interesting feedback hub, so diverse as well, and enlightening as usual. He's back on next month's show, and as alluded to, he's not just back for the feedback hub, because we're going to be discussing the alternate history of the War of the Worlds. Yes, you heard me right. The H.G. Wells novel. What would have happened had he not penned it? And what would have happened had he envisaged a Martian victory at the end of the novel? That and much more besides will be discussed and picked apart, not only by me, not only by Alex, but by a guy called Scott Washburn, who has dedicated a lot of his creative juices to exploring War of the Worlds and alternate history. So he's going to be in an excellent position to make a few comments on it. And we'll be discussing that at the end of September during the next episode of the Alternate History Show, which will be out for you then. Meantime, this music signals we are out of time for today's show. Many thanks for joining me. And between now and the end of September, stay well, stay safe, and enjoy your alternate history, won't you? This is
is the Alternate History Show. We revisit the past, change it, and see what happens. Enough said.
And welcome to part two of the Alternate History Show with me, Ben Kearns. If you haven't heard part one yet, I strongly advise you to do so. In it, we were looking at the best of the Alternate History Show in the past 12 months, revisiting the first episode that we did back in August last year on the Alternate History of the Second World War, and October's episode, which focused on the Beatles and their non-existence in the 60s and their potential continued existence in the 70s and the 80s and beyond. In part two, we're revisiting episodes 3 and 4. Coming up, we got slices of episode 4 a little later on in this half hour when I was joined by Tom Black from Sea Lion Press, and he was here to discuss Brexit in 1975, the idea of the UK leaving the then common market after the first European referendum. This was recorded, by the way, in January of this year, just a few days before the UK's real-life departure from the European Union at the end of January. First of all, let's visit episode 3, which was recorded in December, just before the Christmas holidays, and in keeping with the festivities, we decided to talk about nuclear war. No, we really did, as you do, of course. And in that episode, I was joined by local or regular contributor Alex Wallace and also Colin Salt, who is somewhat of an expert on nuclear weapons and alternate history. And we all put our heads together to discuss what might have happened differently in terms of nuclear power. We discussed the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, what if it had not happened at all, and what if, of course, it had escalated into a nuclear conflict. We also discussed the potential for a nuclear war in 1973 and the idea of a nuclear war in the 80s during the height of mutually assured destruction, and also what could have sparked a nuclear conflict in 1991 and beyond after the disbandment of the USSR. That's all on the way after we talked about the alternate development of the idea of nuclear weapons in the 1940s.
So I was reading Daniel Ellsberg's book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner, which incidentally is one of the scariest books I've ever read.
Right.
From the second part of the book, which is discussing the history of American nuclear doctrine, he argues that a certain Luftwaffe raid on London during World War II was the big sea change, in that the Germans were aiming for this military facility near London, the bombers went off course, the city of London bombed, like, residential areas.
Yeah.
And so how the RAF retaliated was by sending the bombers against German cities.
Mm.
What Ellsberg argues is that a city in and of itself is a valid military target.
Right.
So when the Americans enter the war in Europe, they continue doing this.
Yeah.
Bombing German cities. Most infamous example is Dresden. You also have Pforzheim and Hamburg. Those are some other famous ones. And they bring this doctrine to Japan, in which, knowing fully well that most Japanese cities at the time were built mostly out of wood, they use firebombs to just set the cities aflame. So it's this transformation of the notion of an acceptable target is what Ellsberg argues brought nuclear weapons and their doctrine to be formulated as they were in our reality.
Yeah, so nuclear war, nuclear weapons, as they were, emerged from this raid, which is interesting because I thought, or at least the narrative goes, the Allied powers focused largely on the Manhattan Project as a way to sort of develop the nuclear bomb because they feared the Axis powers may have the idea of developing such a weapon, and they wanted to beat them to it, so to speak.
There was indeed research by the Germans and Japanese for nuclear weapons themselves.
Yes.
However, as you know, they both were, like, the German one was mismanaged a lot, and both of them just had like the Axis, conventional armies, huge shortages of resources. So there wasn't really that much, especially within the time frame of no real chance of them getting a nuclear weapon before the war ended.
Which is interesting, but then I suppose the question is, would the Allies definitely know that? And if
they didn't know that,
no.
It's better to assume the worst. As for if the Manhattan Project could have been stopped, I like to think of the sort of, if you were writing a different story, an actual alternate history story, I'd say the 20 banana peels in a row theorem might at least push it back long enough. Like, there's 100 accidents, a bunch of coincidental accidents all in a row, delay progress on the Manhattan Project to the point where, and this is the big kicker, the US actually has to invade Japan itself.
If we move on to the Cuban Missile Crisis, 1962, October of that year, if that goes hot, Europe will get the brunt, I suppose.
Yeah,
that's basically the
last point in time when the US can come out and truly say that it won. It'll still get hammered. Don't worry. No, questions asked. But by this, but the Soviet arsenal just isn't big enough at this point. Mm. But in a few years, it will be for true mutual destruction.
So are you stipulating that perhaps after a Cuban Missile War, the US is perhaps still a world power, mainly because all the other countries would be hit as well?
Yes.
I mean, probably, yeah. Between the U.S., the Soviet Union, China, and some conglomeration of Western European states, the U.S. is going to come out the best. It's still not going to come out good, but only because everyone else has ceased to exist.
So we move on to the detente era, I suppose, if you call it that, sort of late 60s to late 70s. And a lot of the ideas of nuclear war scenarios arise either during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Some, of course, go back to sort of early to mid 50s with Korea and China and that kind of stuff. And some would focus on sort of the Abel Archer time period. I mean, could there have been a nuclear war? Were there opportunities and sort of pitfalls between those times, however, sort of late 60s to late 70s?
Oh, yeah, definitely the Yom Kippur War was a huge superpower flashpoint in 1973.
Yes,
gigantic.
Yes, yeah.
You have a sort of backing off that's basically because of the Vietnam War, where everything has been backing off. There isn't as much direct confrontation in the decade after Vietnam. But if by some other alternate chance there was, you could definitely see a nuclear scare there. And then, of course, there's what actually inspired the movie War Games. I don't know if you've read about this, Alex. Someone put a simulation tape in the wrong spot, and there was a brief nuclear war scare in the late 70s, that incident. So I'm not saying something like that couldn't have happened elsewhere in the wrong time and place.
Honestly, I think anytime after the Cuban Missile Crisis, the topic of a nuclear war between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, the answer is everybody dies. And frankly, there's not much discussion there.
Yeah.
If you want a nuclear war in which not everybody dies after the Cuban Missile Crisis, you want to look elsewhere. Yom Kippur War, as Colin was saying, also the Sino-Indian border clash in 1962.
Yes.
That's one. Mm. Israeli War in Lebanon, another one. And it's like those little things where one of the great powers could have been drawn into, I think, is the most likely for a situation where not everybody dies.
Yeah. I mean, take Yom Kippur, for example, however, the thing I would have with this, with the idea of a 1973 war, is at some point before it becomes nuclear. I mean, I've heard it said that Israel would have used perhaps a nuclear weapon had things have got to the point where, say, Syria would have invaded, and if they were in danger of invasion, then a nuclear weapon would have been used. My point is, the reason why I think that's perhaps difficult or maybe impossible is Nixon and Brezhnev at that point were, well, whatever else they were, despite their many flaws, they were both fairly foreign policy minded, and Nixon especially, of course, is going to get come under domestic pressure at this point due to Watergate and due to Agnew resigning and all that jazz, basically. And I suppose, despite his outbursts, there's very little scope for cooler heads not to prevail. But you're saying,
yes, I would agree.
Yeah. But it is possible.
Not, it's unlikely, but still cannot be ruled out entirely in the 70s, that point you're talking about.
If that happens, if the Israelis do use a nuclear weapon, I mean, what are the superpowers' responses? What happens after that?
I have to give a disappointing answer and say I don't really know. My gut says I don't see the Soviets immediately launching, but another part of me says it can't be ruled out.
Yeah, I can see at that point potential very high scale, very panicky perhaps, negotiations starting between the two superpowers at that point, had something of that ilk occurred, or even had it been likely, had it even been threatened by the Israelis, I suspect there would be some sort of very high scale diplomatic negotiation. And Kissinger would be earning his pay at the very least in this situation, I'd imagine.
Maybe he could get a Nobel Prize. He actually deserved.
There you go. Let's move on, because we're going to talk now about, a guy who I have been mentioning in the almost infamous segment of the show, a guy called Stanislav Petrov, born in 1939, yes. Of course. Now, I love a romantic hero as much as the next guy, don't get me wrong, but, you know, tellingly, he didn't even admit to saving the world, as a lot of people have speculated that he did do. I mean, did Stanislav Petrov, by keeping a cool head when he saw supposedly a nuclear strike upon Russian soil, five nuclear strikes, should I say, did he prevent, on his own, a third world war and global thermonuclear annihilation? Or is it more complicated than that? Was he being modest, or was he being truthful when he said that he didn't save the world?
I mean, my understanding is that by that point, both the US and the Soviet Union had doctrines of massive retaliation with their nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
So what happened with Petrov is that the computer is saying there was like one or two missiles heading for the Soviet Union, which is what cued him off that it was fake, because had there been a real attack, there would have been thousands of warheads. I think that any sane person who had a knowledge of the nuclear doctrine would have recognized what Petrov saw as fake.
Yeah.
But if you have someone who is incompetent and doesn't get that, everyone dies.
Well, I think that what I think would have realistically happened is that if Petrov sees the alert and doesn't see the alert and stop, then his supervisor would have seen the alert. Then he would have gone, okay, there's no way they would have only launched a few, so it's a fake, so we're calling it off. And that person would get credit as the man who saved the world. So I think Petrov was being truthful, and he was also being modest at the same time. I think those aren't incompatible.
Okay. So basically, if it hadn't been him, it would have been someone else. Perhaps even if it had gone to the head honchos at the Kremlin, then it would have even been them at some point. And I mean, is there any chance that a nuclear war could have developed at that point?
I mean, I think you need to have just the wrong combination of people at that one base in Serpukhov.
Yeah.
That's like what you need. If you don't, at least if there's like one person who isn't like suicidal.
Yeah.
you're good.
Many thanks to Alex Wallace and Colin Salt for lending their expertise to the cause in that episode talking about nuclear war. And I don't mean to sound perverse, but I actually enjoyed talking about nuclear war just before Christmas. Make of that what you will. Make of that what you will. This is Ben Kearns with the Alternate History Show. Onwards to the next episode, then, as we conclude our best of revisits in this half hour, when we discussed Brexit in 1975, the idea of the UK leaving the common market in that year after the first European referendum. In this episode, I was joined by Sea Lion Press's head honcho, Tom Black. We discuss the idea of the UK not joining the EEC in the first place, as well as the idea of a referendum on whether to join the EEC in the 70s, and whether the no vote could have won after a better campaign in 1975, and the political ramifications of an outvote or a closer in vote in that year's referendum. First of all, we tried to take ourselves back to that time and imagine how we would have voted.
Firstly, I'd have to say that if I had been around in 75 with both my heart and my head, as it were, so with my instincts and also thinking about who I would be if you took me back in time to 1975, I would have voted yes, which of course was the ballot option then. It wasn't Remain and Leave, it was yes and
yes.
No.
Yeah.
I would have been a yes voter. I think, obviously, you may not know, my mother is Danish. She came here, in fact, to really cross the timelines, she came here after 1975, but was in part able to come and work here so easily because we were part of the common market as it then was.
Yeah.
Let's say all of that, you know, put all that aside, I'm somehow here and I'm somehow still half Danish. I think fairly obviously, especially given, you know, that my economic profile, that I live in London, and so on, would have placed me firmly in the yes camp anyway. Mm. I'm also, in my other life, I work as an actor. There was a big sort of thesp movement for supporting yes. I would have voted yes. Would I have been right to do so? That's getting into interesting.
In your opinion?
I mean, in my opinion, yeah, sure. I mean, when you look at the journey that Britain and Europe have had together over the last 40, 50 years, I say 40, 50 because, you know, it's not going to end with what's happening next week. It's our relationship with the European Union is changing in a massive way. But as even the Brexiteers these days say, Europe is still there and we're going to have to deal with it. Is it going to have turned out that on the one hand, that the common market is what people voted for in 75 and they didn't want a political union that we ended up getting with the Treaty of Maastricht in the 90s, and that was just inevitably going to split us away from them? Maybe that will be the popular view of things, and maybe that will therefore sort of start to feel consistently true. Or is it going to be the case that you know, Britain ends up having egg on her face because of how the decision that was made in 2016 gets implemented, but also because the British failure to buy in. I mean, again, on the flip side, even a lot of Remainers admit that Britain never enthusiastically participated in the European project, even when we were active members of the European Union or indeed the EEC. Mm. So I don't know. I think probably with all my biases, I'd have to say that, of course, I would have been right to vote yes. But the question would have been whether the rest of the country was ever going to truly get on board with the European project. I mean, I think that's one of the most interesting points on this that I've never really been able to come up with an interesting counter to, annoyingly, is made by a good friend of mine, Tom Anderson. You may know him as the author of the Look to the West series.
Oh, yes.
Or Fanned, and
yes.
He's known on the various forums. Yeah, fantastic writer and a very educated man. He made the point that if you watch footage of excited young people, he was watching it for footage of excited young people in Doncaster back in 1975, celebrating the yes vote, campaigning for a yes vote. And he said, if you just do simple maths and you look at how old those people are now and where they live in the country as well, particularly somewhere like Doncaster, it's the same people who were overjoyed to be voting yes back in 1975 were the bulk of the older over 65
leave. Who were overjoyed to be voting leave.
Exactly. So something did change in that time. And that sort of maybe gets us to maybe we were never going to buy in properly. Or maybe, I guess, the third option, the sort of the blame Tony Blair option, as I like to call it, though it's not entirely his fault, is that so many British politicians spent so many decades blaming Europe for things that weren't actually strictly Europe's fault. Famously, the imperial measurements thing. I'm sure we all remember that.
Yeah.
The EU didn't actually ban imperial measurements. They just said we had to use both metric and imperial. And the British government decided, well, we'll just get rid of imperial and say that it's Brussels. Anyway, that's my sort of, spitball on political Europe anyway.
Well, it's interesting because I did hear in the run-up to the 2016 referendum an interview between, I think it was Neil Kinnock and Nigel Lawson, who, of course, famously, of course, switched from Remain or Yes to Leave in the 2016. Of course, Kinnock went the other way. So, yeah, it's interesting that you had those sort of reverse.
It's bizarre to think about that. David Owen,
I was a bit flabbergasted when I heard about that, actually, but that's all good. It's all good. It's good to be flabbergasted occasionally. Okay, let's move on to, well, what would have happened, what could have happened in 1975. First of all, I mean, is it possible to flip the referendum result? Not exactly as such, but, you know, bearing in mind it was quite a hefty yes vote, how could no have possibly won it?
As I kind of warned you about it when we were emailing, actually, I think I'm going to be a bit boring here and say that I'm not really sure it can be, depending on how far back you go. And you may then get into the point, then the discussion of hard alternate history, whether it's really the same referendum if you change all of these things. I think the issue that you have is that how much in lockstep the establishment came out on side for yes in 75, and also the usual, with the exception of 2016, tendency for British people to vote to maintain the status quo unless the status quo has very, very, very visibly been shaken or indeed proved to be completely untenable. For example, 79 and even 45, people, just a slight tangent there, people often see 1945 as a bit of a bolt from the blue thing. But people often say, well, when you remember that the 1945 election was meant to happen in 1940 and it was just delayed, look at how angry people were about the Depression, about appeasement. And then, of course, we had 5 years of war. People were just waiting to elect something very, very different. So we obviously didn't have a situation like that in 1975. There's certainly arguments that will be made that we apparently did in 2016. People felt the situation was so broken. And I think it really does come back to Heath taking us into Europe in 72 or 1st of January 73 without a public vote, without a referendum. We shouldn't forget, of course, that I believe the EEC referendum in 75 was Britain's first ever nationwide referendum.
Are you saying that Heath could have called a referendum to join the EEC? This would have been 1972 time.
Yes, I think he wouldn't have done. I think the tricky bit is how you get him to, because he'd need to just sort of hit his head and decide it's a good idea.
Yeah,
because it's not a good idea, because actually, given what I was just saying about the status quo, I think that is much more losable than a 1975 should we stay in or not referendum.
Right.
There's a very good, in fact, in Remain Means Remain, a collection of short stories that I edited about Britain and Europe, that's available with Sea Lion Press, hope plugs are allowed, contains a story in it, very good one, by Greg Grant. In fact, funnily enough, we don't have a story that covers referendum going the other way, because it just proved too difficult for anyone to really justify it. So what he does instead, Greg's really good story, is he writes a story of Heath being convinced to call a referendum back in 72.
Right.
And then it goes, it goes the wrong way from Heath and the Europeans' perspective.
Right.
It ends up, it has a few parallels with 2016, but I think they're actually pretty solid. Obviously, Enoch Powell becomes the first sort of Tory to break away and cause a big ruckus and start campaigning. Kind of like, he's sort of seen as the Michael Gove figure. Not that Michael Gove has everything in common with Enoch Powell.
Yeah.
Whatever my personal thoughts on that man may be. And then Thatcher As in former then sitting education secretary.
Yes, yes.
Margaret Hilda Thatcher is the sort of Boris Johnson figure of Heath wasn't counting on her jumping ship and siding with the outers, and of course she's got a big connection with the conservative grassroots. That leads to a bit of a domino effect, and we also end up with Wilson campaigns against joining,
right?
Which is a nice touch. He ends up typically opportunistically realizes this is a way to majorly wound Heath, and I don't think Harold Wilson would ever walk away from an opportunity to wound Ted Heath. So then you've got the leader of the opposition actively campaigning against us joining the EEC, and you've got a popular Conservative frontbencher, and you've got Enoch Powell, who does indeed command a fair chunk of votes at this point, and as well as the sort of what was unfairly characterised as a clown car of ridiculous figures in 1975 campaigning to leave. In real life, I'm sure we've all seen the cartoons of Enoch Powell, Michael Foote, Tony Benn, Barbara Castle, and various trade unionists, all in and the SNP as well, of course. They were anti Europe, and I think it was exact. It was an exact flip, wasn't it?
I think so. I think Alex Salmon made a particularly famous comment at the time. Which has since become famous, of course. This is the Alternate History Show with me, Ben Kearns. Many thanks for joining me today, and you are listening to the best of the Alternate History Show. We're almost done, but we've got half an hour to go, and you just heard a montage of clips from episode 4 of the programme, where I was conversing with Tom Black from Sea Lion Press, the head honcho of the Alternate History Publishing Company, about the idea of the UK leaving the common market in 1975. And the UK's relationship with Europe in the past 6 decades and how it could have changed since the formation of the European Common Market in 1957. Many thanks to Tom, and I must say it was an absolute honour to be acquainted with him after reading lots of his work in the past few years or so. Right, coming up in part 3 of the Alternate History Show, we continue with some of the best of bits as we discuss the best of the 60-second summary. That's where I give you a few tips on alternate history media and literature generally. That's on the way in about 5 minutes' time. Plus, our feedback hub. We'll catch up on all the new goings-on in alternate history with Alex Wallace. That's all on the way.
With a sideways look at history, including discussions, reviews of alternate history media, and your comments, this is the Alternate History Show with Ben Kearns.
It most definitely is. Thank you for joining me. It is good to be back, and I must say thanks for your continued patience during these very trying months. And we are now back on track, which is all good news. And we're doing a bit of a special alternate history show for you today. Stand by for a few best of bits from the show over the past 12 months. Over the past year, we've been talking about such topics as World War II, and we've even traversed the rocky waters of nuclear power as well, not forgetting Brexit in 1975, the idea of the UK leaving the then common market in 1975. And we've even stopped off to talk about the Beatles as well. You'll be hearing clips from all those shows between now and the end of today's Alternate History programme. Over the next hour in particular, stay with us as we revisit some of the highlights that you may have missed and encourage you to listen to the shows in full. As well as that, we have got some new material towards the end of today's show. We'll be doing our feedback hub later, joined by Alex Wallace as normal, to discuss what has been going on in the world of alternate history and what he has been doing over the past few months regarding AH and what I have been up to as well. Plus details on how you can get involved with future shows, details of what's coming up on this show in October, and how you can get involved with future shows on a wide range of topics from JFK to the Hanoverians. lots more besides. And we want your comments as well on this show and on future Alternate History Show episodes. We'll give you more details on how you can go about that as well.
It's history with a twist. You're listening to the Alternate History Show with Ben Kearns.
And let's start by talking about our very first episode almost a year ago. We were talking about World War II coinciding with the 80th anniversary of the German occupation of Poland. In that episode, we talked about the Pact of Steel, we discussed the implications of the Munich Agreement not happening, and we talked about an elongated war and a shortened war due to the invasion of France failing, as well as the typical surrender of the Allies in 1940. As well as that, we discussed the ongoing war in Africa and how the war could have ended differently in 1945, albeit with an Allied victory, had D-Day been a failure. Before all that, though, we were discussing how World War II could have been prevented as late as possible and the complications thereof.
In my opinion, there's just so much left over from Versailles.
Yeah.
Something's going to happen. You have Poland becoming independent. You have all the shifting colonies.
Mm.
You have the actual punitive measures imposed by Versailles.
Mm.
And this is where my half-Asian part's coming out. My reminder to you that World War II started in 1937 in China.
Mm.
And so the Japanese felt really screwed over that because they wanted Germany's Chinese colonies. They didn't get it, so they were mad.
Mm.
And so that's when they walk into Manchuria after Mukden, and then the rest of the country after Marco Polo Bridge. So, I mean, Versailles really set the stage for everything after 1939, honestly.
What about in 1938? Because, of course, you had, by this point, the Pact of Steel was pretty much a solid pact. And although a lot of the Allied powers wanted to detach Mussolini from Hitler and that kind of stuff, you had the Munich crisis and the Munich conference. What if that had gone sour, so to speak? So you have war in 1938. I've heard it said that Hitler himself would have preferred a war at that point, but then I've heard it said from the Allied point of view that it would have been better for the Allies to have a war in 1938. Who's right in that equation? Is it wishful thinking on our behalf or on the Nazis' behalf?
I mean, I just think in general it's hard for Germany to win one of these wars.
Yeah.
I think that was the premise of the war that came early,
yeah.
Eternal Love, the War of the Sudetenland.
Because it's interesting, because you get a lot of people in proclaiming that a 1938 war would probably end pretty swiftly in a few months. It would all be over by Christmas, to paraphrase a 1914 statement, so to speak. But then others would say, if not going on for 5 or 6 years, it would have dragged on till 1941, 1942, and would have been nearly as destructive as 1939 to 1945. So where do you see a 1938 war playing out? How do you see it playing out?
I think it would last at least a few years. It depends if Hitler is stupid enough to invade the Soviet Union. Which, granted, this
which
is Hitler.
He probably would well. Be, I would imagine.
I mean, Germany is just so logistically hard. Its logistics are so bad compared to the British and the French and the Russians that it's hard for them to win.
Move on to the Battle of Britain, which took place over the British skies. Now, I've heard a lot of people say that pretty much it was predetermined from the get-go how that was going to go. But what's the closest we can get to a Nazi victory at the Battle of Britain, and what would it look like?
You avoid that shift where the Luftwaffe ceases bombing airfields and starts bombing London.
Yeah.
If they focus on RAF airfields, they will do much better. But the thing is, you know, these are Nazis we're talking about, and they live for that big symbolic strike. So it's a temptation that they're always going to have.
They're
going to
bomb London because of the political consequences as they see it. I suppose.
Yes. Mm. I mean, I've seen it argued that fascism is politics as a spectacle, as aesthetic.
Mm.
And I think, at least in part, that can be shown in the Nazi war effort, them going for London, especially for Stalingrad, because one of the reasons Hitler went for Stalingrad, because they met for Stalin.
Mm.
Granted, it also gave the Soviets access to the Baku oil fields. But there was a strategic reason to go for it, but there... It being named after the enemy leader was one of the reasons why Hitler's ego was felt compelled to go for it.
It's got to be done, that kind of thing, basically. Yes. Yeah, okay.
That's the issue with the Nazis. They want to do these, frankly, kind of stupid things for reasons that aren't strictly military. That's why it's so hard to have them win.
Yeah. Basically, the personalities get in the way, that kind of stuff. So, yeah. Okay. And if they would win, it wouldn't be, they wouldn't be the Nazis, basically. Pretty much. So what would be the best that they could hope for from the Battle of Britain? They bombed airfields, so to speak.
I mean, if they,
what would happen then?
If they focus solely on the infrastructure.
Yeah.
The best they can get is a negotiated settlement,
yeah,
and ending the U-boat war and ending the British blockade of Germany.
Yeah.
Trying to normalize relations with the rest of the world and casting themselves as the anti-communists when they go and beat up the Russians.
Mm.
That's probably the best they can get from the Battle of Britain, realistically.
Let's have a look at the American involvement in World War II, of course, because they came on board after the attack on Pearl Harbor in December of 1941. Could that have been prevented in any way, shape or form? We know that FDR and a lot of people around him and a lot of the public after the fall of France in particular were very much sort of thinking that they needed to get involved in 1941, beyond, of course, Lend-Lease and being a sort of a neutral power, albeit on the Allied side. I mean, could that have... Could the US have been kept neutral at least for longer? And could they have come in earlier as well, actually?
I mean, earlier is hard. It depends on what Japan does and what Germany does after Japan attacks.
Yeah.
Because the Japanese are just waiting to pounce on the European colonies in East Asia.
Yeah.
And
I guess the rationale to a certain degree as well is we need to get the Americans involved now and deal with them before they build up their strength, because they were at that point building up there. They'd had the biggest peacetime buildup of defences.
Yeah, I mean, there was a draft going on before the formal American entry into the war.
Yeah.
I mean, if you want to change that, change Japan's supply situation, because they wanted to, Americans, they embargoed Japan, food, sell them oil, and that was having the war in China go very poorly.
Yeah.
And so they needed to invade somewhere to get those resources, and so they attacked Hawaii to knock out the American fleet. Didn't go as well as they had hoped, but have Pearl Harbor go better and like thoroughly destroy the base, that would help them.
Yeah,
it helps with knocking out American capacity to deploy forces into the Asia Pacific region.
Yeah,
it's what was called in my international security class in college anti-Axis area denial, or A2AD. Not necessarily destroying the enemy's capacity to make forces, but the enemy's capacity to ship forces to where they need to be. So if they can like destroy Pearl Harbor, destroy Hawaii's use as a way of getting troops from the mainland U.S. to the Asia-Pacific theater, that will help them.
Okay.
And they can help to take out the Philippines, destroy the Philippines there, destroy the forces of the Philippines, and then they can take Vietnam and Indonesia, etc.
I mean, what would that do exactly to the length of the war? I'm assuming that at some point they're going to slip up, but how long do you envisage that taking, and how much more costly could that be?
I mean, I could add up to a year to the Americans, because they need to retake Hawaii, and then go on the island hopping campaign.
Mm.
At that time, the Japanese could be using the time to cement their hold in China and in Burma, have the war against the British in India and Burma go better, put down resistance in the China and Indonesia and the Philippines, and just generally consolidate these holdings, and they'd be better equipped to fight the Americans should they be bogged down. It all depends, of course, on how well they fortify Hawaii.
Okay, let's move on to D-Day and the invasion, the reoccupation, not invasion, the reoccupation of France in 1944. What we do know, of course, is that General Eisenhower at the time had a speech in case D-Day was a failure, which I suppose it could well have been in that case. Lots of people considered it highly risky. Didn't they? So, I mean, how could the invasion of France have gone worse for the Allies? And what could have happened?
I mean, there's the whole thing about that those German divisions that didn't get moved because Hitler was asleep. They didn't want to wake him up. So if they just wake him up and those divisions go,
that's one of my favourite points of departure, actually, as far as this is concerned. So have someone Hitler sleeping could have affected things. Carry on.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I think by this point, especially after Stalingrad is decided decisively in favor of the Soviets, the Germans are doomed. It's just a matter of when.
Yeah.
I go back to that R.M. Melek story. I mean, if D-Day doesn't go as well as it does, and the war is dragged out for a few more months, nukes go off over Germany.
Yeah.
They nuke the Ruhr, they nuke Dresden, they nuke several other cities, probably in Bavaria too. So it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when.
It's a matter of when, but it's also a matter of how it ends as well, I suppose.
Yes.
So, I mean, is it an automatic, definite, if D-Day goes badly, and if it happens, 1945, the war is still going on, a nuke definitely flies? Is that definitely going to happen? Is that pretty much, there's going to be a German city that gets a nuke at least?
Yes, I do believe that is the case. The reason why the atomic bomb was developed in the U.S. to begin with was to be used on Germany. There's a whole letter by a dissident German scientist to Roosevelt saying, build a nuke or the Germans will get it. The only reason they didn't use it against the Germans in the real world is because they wasn't ready by the time the Germans surrendered.
Yeah.
Had the war gone on in Europe, they would have nuked Germany.
You're listening to the Alternate History Show. My name is Ben Kearns, and we are revisiting what we have discussed in the past 12 months. You've just been listening to our very first episode on the Second World War, recorded in August last year. Back in October of 2019, we did episode 2, and we focused on the Beatles, and that's what we're going to hear now. I was joined by a guy from the alternatehistory.com forums called Black and the Borg. That was his username, and he was talking about his extensive Beatles knowledge, using it to tell us what he thought would have happened had Beatles signed to Decca, what would have happened had the Beatles continued to record, how the split could have been avoided, and how the Beatles could have reunified before and after John Lennon's assassination. First of all, though, we discussed what would have happened in the 60s with no Beatles. Without the Beatles, would the 60s still swing?
Well, I think it would have had some sort of swinging adjacent type cultural miasma, considering that regardless of the Beatles, we would have had the innovations such as the birth control pill and LSD, that sort of thing. You would have seen something very similar emerge. However, the Beatles had a particularly large stake in the subculture because, they did Sgt. Pepper's, and that kind of became the universal symbol of the swinging 60s, all the colorful fashion. They were kind of the trendsetters. If they were doing something, the rest of the world took note and went, I'm going to do that too. So in their wake, there probably would have been some sort of successor group such as that. I think the Beach Boys might have gone a bit off the handle. Maybe the Rolling Stones would have been more influential in the United Kingdom. But it would have been noticeably different.
It's interesting as well, because that facilitates another thing I was thinking of earlier on. What would the career of George Martin have been like without the Beatles, of course?
There's a lot of debate on whether or not this would have amounted to anything, because both prior and during the Beatles' careers, George Martin was very involved in the orchestral side of producing. He had previously, I think outside of orchestra, he had only done production work for country groups, you know, like the old banjo plucking washboard kind of people. And during 1968, during the production of the Yellow Submarine film, he did provide an entire orchestral suite that he did compose himself. You can actually find this on side 2 of the Yellow Submarine album. It's not great if you don't like classical music, but it's still enough of a point that you could see where he would go. There's a lot of individuals who would just not come to household names if they were just left to their own devices without the Fabs.
Definitely, definitely. Okay, so we imagine now we come forward to their signing to EMI. What would the Beatles look like into the 60s when they became famous with Pete Best as a member? I mean, there are various theories as to why he was dropped.
The overarching theory to that, according to most autobiographies you can find out there, Mark Lewisham is a very good source for this. This is Beatles tune-in. The studio executives were not in any way happy with Pete Best drumming as they were recording test tracks, and Brian Epstein relayed this to the group and went, we might have to find a new drummer. And very luckily, they had met Richard Starkey, better known as Ringo, in Hamburg back in the late 50s. So they knew him, and Brian rung him up and said, do you want to come down to the studio? And the rest is history, kind of. They just kind of awkwardly told Pete Best he wouldn't be in the group anymore. Well, Brian told him, actually. None of the Fabs actually met him face-to-face post-firing. And if you actually listen to Pete Best's strumming in comparison to Ringo's, whilst Ringo's is a bit more simple, he does have a better tempo, a better rate. I would argue he's the superior drummer, especially in the early days. Not to mention, their friendship with Ringo became more solidified than it was to Pete Best. Pete Best was kind of, in a way that is not offensive, again, I admire the man, kind of like a auxiliary member of the group. They were not as cohesive as they were when they had Ringo. So a lot of the group interplay may have not come about in Ringo's absence, and they might have not had enough of the charisma and the in-jokes that made them so endearing to fans over the years.
A lot of conspiracy theorists find this particularly fertile ground. I do love the conspiracy theories surrounding the supposed death of Paul McCartney. What if the conspiracy theorists were right? What if he did die in that car accident? What would happen to the band?
What do you mean if?
Well, yeah, yes.
The band clearly deceased. He's not wearing any shoes, it's obvious! I find the concept of not only Paul McCartney dying in 1966 and no one knowing about it, and then subsequently taking part in the most successful cover-up of all time, to be like a ridiculous scenario, because considering who Paul McCartney was, if he sneezed, it would be on the news. Like, you think he's going to crash his car and, as some of the some of the rumors note, get decapitated and his hair set on fire? That people would not tack onto that. The excuse they give is that they're brought before MI5 by, like, the Secret Service. And the Secret Service informed them, we are going to cover this up. We are going to replace your man with an identical person because everyone would be very upset. Their excuse was there could be suicides. So the government was like, this is an issue. We need to figure this out. This is our number one priority. Not the Cold War, not British intelligence, not the Falklands, no.
Devaluation or anything like that. No, it's all about this. It's all about, yeah.
Make sure those girls don't get sad that the music artist has died.
It strikes me as beyond absurd, really. But let's say that he actually did die in 1966, definitively, and there is no question about that. What would happen to the band after that?
Okay, so is the assumption that he dies and there is no cover-up, or...
He just dies. He just dies. There's absolutely no cover-up or anything like that attempted.
There's no Willie Campbell.
Of course. Yeah, of course.
Well, unfortunately for the group, Paul McCartney was an integral component of the band. He's half of Lennon McCartney. He is 1/4 of the Beatles. Without him, I would argue that there is no replacing him. He's integral. He is constant.
Would the Beatles even try and carry on in this scenario?
I wouldn't say that at all, actually. Like, by all means, around that time, the group was so cohesive that if... Okay, like, let's use the example. John Lennon was... He's a sensitive wee soul. When he had people in his life, he would become very attached to them. So to lose someone as significant as Paul McCartney suddenly in a traffic accident, that would probably break the man. He would probably not care anymore about music. He'd probably just hobble himself up. He'll just, like, leave the music scene, probably, just because he'd be in such grief for a time. If that makes any sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. It is, I've heard a lot of people, I've heard some people say that.
You're essentially ruining the entire structure of the band. The band cannot stand without all four of its components.
It's interesting because the following year, of course, Brian Epstein passed away, and the Beatles did carry on for a couple of years afterwards, and John Lennon was fine regarding... Well, not exactly, you know what I mean, anyway.
Fine.
Yeah.
He was very emotionally distraught.
Of course.
Because, you know, Brian was their manager. Very close.
But
you also... Brian didn't write any songs.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's move on to the aforementioned. Anyway, Brian Epstein. What if he had survived and hadn't taken the overdose, perhaps survived it with minimal damage and was around for the Beatles? In short, did Brian Epstein's demise, did his death lead to the breakup of the band?
Prior to Epstein's death, he was not in a lot of capacities required because they were growing as artists and had retreated into the studio away from touring. They were mostly dependent on their own actions and didn't require a man to shepherd them about like they would in their touring days. Brian was very good when it came to touring. He was not overtly needed after that. So if he'd survived, he would have mainly just been used as a voice of persuasion, because as both Paul McCartney and John Lennon pointed out after their breakup, after the band's breakup, they did state that Paul attempted to fill the void left by Mr. Epstein, and as a result, he attempted to take de facto control of the group, which didn't sit well with John, and then that created resentment, rah rah rah. So without Epstein's demise, it's entirely possible that the group would have continued. Now, would this necessarily result in a tour? I would not say that at all, but it's entirely possible that band relations would have been improved. I'm not too sure.
Shifting on now to Yoko Ono, the woman who perhaps received more opprobrium than, well, a lot of people to do with the Beatles, including Magic Alex, including Alan Klein. So, does she deserve the opprobrium that she gets? In short, I suspect I know what you're going to say to this, but did Yoko Ono break up the Beatles, or is the truth, as I imagine it is, somewhat more nuanced?
It's nuanced as hell, my man. There is not one contributing factor for the breakup of the Beatles. Yoko Ono was, of course, a new factor. However, it was as much John's fault as it was Yoko, because with John, he insisted that she be in the studio. He insisted that she be at their side all the time, because he was developing a new relationship and he wanted to be with her at all times. So it was as much John's change in personality as it was her, but also the reason Mr. Epstein's death is such a contentious issue for the breakup of the band was that he left a power vacuum, and then you had Paul McCartney try and wade around in that power vacuum, and the Beatles weren't too happy about that. And then when they needed a new manager, he volunteered his new in-laws, the father and brother.
Yes, the Eastmans, which we'll come on to a little bit later on, actually.
And this came off as him trying to have absolute control over the group, like the manager, the finances, everything. And to counter that, the rest of the Beatles fell in behind Al Klein, who was a bit of a tit, to be perfectly honest. He was a...
I think that's a very mild way of putting it. I've heard a lot of people describe him as far worse.
I don't want to swear on the show.
Yeah, we'd better not. We'd better not. But yes, yeah. I'm glad you didn't. But I get exactly what you're saying.
And that formed a whole load more conflicts that arose from that, and it snowballed out of control. If you remove Yoko from the equation, it's entirely possible that Lennon just becomes an unworkable blob who's very upset. Yoko gave him I would argue some sort of revitalization with his creative thing. He wanted to be more experimental the entire time he was in the group, and finally he had someone to enable him in that way, because Yoko was very, she's Yoko. We all know what she's like.
Yes, yeah.
No offense to the woman, but her screaming idea is still very avant-garde, even in 2019.
Will be in 2090 as well, I'd imagine.
I would argue that, in a way, Yoko was majorly a creative influence. She essentially lit a fire from under him, and then he went off going, whoa, Revolution Number 9, hey, Plastic Ono Band, whoa, you know, that sort of angle. Without that, he probably would have just, like, I don't know, become more of a dependent addict to heroin, which he was trying out in the late 60s, and it's entirely possible he would have had an accident had he not had a more dependent entity.
It's the Alternate History Show with me, Ben Kearns, and this is episode 5 of the Alternate History Show. Thank you for being with us. It is the first one we've done in quite a while for fairly obvious reasons. It's good to be back in the saddle, though, for today's Alternate History Show. And if you're wondering what's happening, we're doing a bit of a memory refresher throughout today's show, revisiting what we have previously done in the past 12 months since the podcast got going. Now, in episode 1, you heard, of course, us talking about World War II and the alternate history of the Second World War, and you'd just been listening to a montage of clips from a conversation that I was having with alternate history user Black and the Borg in episode 2 of the show, focusing on alternate Beatles and the 60s without the Beatles, and the 70s and the 80s and beyond with the continued existence of the Fab Four. Much more coming up later in part 2 of the Alternate History Show. We will revisit episode 3 of the show, where we discuss nuclear power from the 40s to the present day and the alternate history of it, and also Brexit in 1975. That's in part 2.